Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You hang up being there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
All right, it's time for another installment of It's My House. And today I'll jump off topic. Then we can go to other topics, strength, anything you guys want to talk about, is human settlement distinctions and single industry towns. Human settlement distinctions and single industry towns. So for some of you might be asking, what's a human settlement? So we'll go through that. We'll be right back in 2 minutes.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank a three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, morning, little morning motivation. So if Jamarian Stiles, who we're working on getting him here live in studio, if he can make the basketball team with no hands, make the team with no hands, get in the game and score 6 points in one game with no hands, then we have all our limbs and digits. We have absolutely no excuse. All right, today our jump off topic are human settlement distinctions in single industry terms. Okay, definition. What is a human settlement? A human settlement is essentially a place that has a population of humans. The population could be one person or it could be 8 million people. But a human settlement is essentially, at its core, a place where you have human beings. It can just be one person, like, so it can be millions of people. Now, there are different distinctions of human settlements. And the names I'm going to put out there, you've all heard the names before. You have, all right, first thing, fundamentally, if you see just people milling around in a particular spot and they're living there, that's a human settlement. Now, here are the different distinctions. You have villages. You have hamlets. These are basically typically small places. Hamlets are typically smaller than villages, all right? You have towns, you have cities, and then even with cities, you have different classifications of cities. You know, first class, second class, third class, fourth class city, all right? But those are your and then you have metropolises, which are, you know, huge. But those are all different distinctions of human settlements. Now, depending on where you are in the United States or around the world, in order to be classified as a town, you have to meet certain legal requirements and political requirements. And or if you want to be classified as a city, the same thing. Now, putting that out there because anybody within the sound of my voice, if you wanted to, you can start your own town, but there's some steps to take. Now, last Thursday, We had three young ladies on from the Freedom Georgia Initiative. Three ladies that live in Metro Atlanta, Georgia, and they ran across like 97 acres of land that they can purchase. Now, their mission, and you can go to their website and read the whole mission statement and all that, with pictures and all that. They have a YouTube channel called Freedom Georgia. They wanted to establish a community where they can call the shots politically. They can implement their ideas now. Instead of going through, because, like, once again, they live in Metro Atlanta, so let's put them in Atlanta proper. If you want to change the system in Atlanta, and that's why I play Claude Anderson to start each one of these podcasts, you got to bankroll the system. You know, you got to bankroll people around the table, the city council, you know, who's running for mayor. It's a whole lot of politics, and it's very expensive to try to fix any city of any size is, you know, political scene and economics and all that. It's easy to do it if you just start from scratch. So that's what they're doing. They went out and they purchased, they talked to about 10 friends each out of the 30 possible friends that they spoke to. They came up with 19 families. 19 families got together and they purchased 97 acres of land. Actually, 96.71 acres, but I'm just saying. So each one of the 19 families got at least two acres of land. Maybe some of them got 6 acres, but and then, you know, they come together and they, you know, they learn how to put together infrastructure and all of whatever they had to do, and they'll be growing their own food or whatever. But and it's a 2-hour drive from where they live at in Metro Atlanta, at least the people that we had on last Thursday. So, but anybody can do that. Now, they've gone from 97 acres. They're up to 502 acres now. All right, so there, and they learned a whole lot about that. What I call what they're doing is the ultimate power move when it comes to civil rights. Because you can march and you can protest in Atlanta and St. Louis and anywhere all day long, but how far are you going to get? So that's what we're talking about, human settlements. And we'll talk about this topic more frequently and then have offline projects on. If you want to do something like what they're doing, you can do the same thing. But it all starts off with you buying a piece of land, typically raw land, and then putting together a plan on how you're going to develop that into the particular community that you want. Now, one type of human settlement, because you can take, once you get, and keep this in mind too, every town that you've ever set foot in, every town that you've ever heard of, it all, everything starts with one. It's one person who had an idea or one person who had a vision. Just like with the Freedom Georgia Initiative, in this case, it started with two women and quickly a third one, and then now they're up to 502 acres. And they just started this like in 2020 is when they first came across the first 97 acres. So now, after you get the land, all right, and you want to think long term, like, because if you might want to, and first thing, they got the land in an unincorporated area in a county in Georgia. So that's the first thing. That gives them the leeway. That gives them a little bit more room to make up their own rules. But eventually, I believe, I'm not speaking for them, but from what I've heard them say, and we have their program from last Thursday in our archives. Anybody can listen to it on demand. They, I think they eventually probably want to have a municipal charter. In other words, they want to incorporate, because they have a CEO for the Freedom Georgia, and she was on here last Thursday as well. They have a CEO for it already. But they want to do a, I think they're going to be moving towards eventually going from a basic fundamental settlement. Once again, a human settlement is just a population of people. It can be one person. In their case, it started with 19 families. I don't know how collectively how many people that is, but, you know, that's what it is for now. So with that, if they get a municipal charter and incorporate their holdings, then they can, they have the power to have a mayor, have a city council, if they so choose to do so, have a police force. I've been in municipalities in this country, and in the United States, give or take, there are 19,500 municipalities in the United States. They range within a population of a towns. There are several towns in the United States that have a population of one person, believe it or not. All right. Up to several million, as in a New York City or Los Angeles, California, or what do you call it, Chicago, Illinois. There are only 10 towns, municipalities in the United States that have populations of a million or more people. And once again, but there are 19,500 of them, towns that have municipal corporations. There are also probably just as many, if not double that number, of towns in the United States that have no municipal charter. They don't want one for various reasons. Some of the towns that I've been in that do have municipal charters, they have elected that the citizens, along with the city council and the mayor's office, they say, you know what, and these towns might have maybe 300 people, 350 people. They have elected, you know what, we don't need a police force. Everybody knows everybody, so they're self-police. There's a bunch of towns like that all around the United States. So if you don't feel safe in Chicago or Seattle, Washington, or whatever, you know, drive within an hour or two-hour radius of wherever that is and find a spot that might be already established to set up camp. But anyway, these human settlements, like I say, they go by various names, outposts, village, towns, cities. Where the action is best is in unincorporated areas. And this is for the people who have a pioneering spirit. Most people are not, they don't have a pioneering spirit. Because we're talking about what these ladies did was they found that everything they bought was off the grid. You know, they don't want, I'll be speaking for them. Because I buy land, too. So I recommend, I like to buy raw land. I don't want municipal water because I know how to do well water and I know how to harvest rainwater. I don't want I don't want nothing from the government. Nothing. Now, if their property taxes have to be paid, I'll gladly pay it. Because typically, property taxes on raw land in rural areas typically is very cheap, so I'll dance into the tax assessor's office to pay those. But as far as taking service, I mean, this is just crazy me now. I don't want municipal water because I think municipal water is expensive. And I know how to set up all those systems myself. So, but I'm just saying that I think it's the ultimate power move if you set up your own town. Or community, because once again, there are different distinctions and legalities. I'm happy with just, you know, we got a settlement, and there's no rules and regulations, to my knowledge, on, you know, how many acres. You know, there are towns in this country that might have 15 acres, and some towns that might have 5 acres. There are other towns that have over 10,000 acres and even over 19,000 acres. So, but there's a lot out there. So we'll go more into details on that. Now, another topic we want to go into is single industry towns. single industry towns, also known as company towns or towns. As a matter of fact, there's one I like you to look up. Blue Oval City. Blue Oval City. Blue Oval City is in Tennessee. And Ford Motor Company, I believe, they've already bought the land, and I think they're going to open it up in like 2 or 3 years. That is supposed to be an electric vehicle assembly plant. That's what they plan on putting there. So look up when you get a chance, Blue Oval City, which you may as well say Blue Oval City, Tennessee. Then you have another place you might want to check out, Yoder, Kansas. Now, Yoder, Kansas is an Amish community. And many Amish are entrepreneurs. They have family-based businesses. And I think Yoder has a population of 165 people. But it's an entrepreneurial community. And if you look up Amish settlements online, or Amish and Mennonite settlements, because they're close. Well, what Amish are like old school. They're really not into electronics that much. They might be dealing with solar panels right now. I'm not sure. However, and they got different denominations of sects of you know, Amish and all that. But the Mennonites are a little bit more tech friendly. You know, they definitely had the solar panels. They use smartphones and computers and desktops and all that type of stuff. So, but if you go look, just type in any search engine, Amish settlements or Amish communities or Amish community map. I believe you have Amish in 32. They're primarily in 32 out of the 50 states they have a presence. And they have, Yoder's just one town. Okay. So they have quite a few merchant-based communities, the Amish and the Mennonites do, and not only in the United States, but they're global as well. Well, the Mennonites probably might be more, but it's all online. But these are all, you know, settlements. So if you notice, the Amish, you know, you're not going to see any Amish other than for sightseeing purposes in downtown Manhattan or San Diego or Los Angeles, California. Okay. But where they set up shop for their businesses, you know, baking shoe fly pies, making furniture, building cabins, barns, tiny houses, whatever, they typically set up shop in rural areas. So the states where they have the most concentration of Amish people, I think, will be in the state of Pennsylvania, followed by Ohio, followed by Indiana, but they're in 32 states. So you have you have Amish settlements in at least 32 out of 50 states. Even for historical purposes, for African Americans, black folk, there are, I understand, between maybe 800 to 900 historic black townships in the United States. I've been to a few of them, and quite a few of those are over 100 years old. So, and we've done a number of podcasts over on some of those over the years, as well as done road trips. So, there is a trend, and then we got new type of communities popping up with settlements. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago at UCLA. University of California, Los Angeles, they even have a Facebook page on this one. They have what is called a safe parking program. And the safe parking program is a parking lot that's designated for students who are living out of their cars, trucks, vans, campers, or RVs. The Los Angeles area of California is very expensive. So, you know, they're paying tuition, then they got to eat. And for some reason, they can't afford to rent a room or share a house or an apartment or what have you. So they're living out of their cars. Now, if you go on YouTube, there's a never-ending slew of videos with new ones being uploaded around the hour, around the clock, of people living in their cars, vans, trucks, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you got single mothers, you got single parents, but UCLA has a safe parking program. You can look that up online. Walmart, not all Walmarts, but some Walmarts have a safe parking program where you can camp out there overnight. I think some of the Cracker Barrels have a safe parking program. And a handful of cities are adopting that. All right. So because it's just housing prices are just through the roof in many parts of the country. So people are looking for sustainable ways. But the safe parking program is a settlement. Because remember the definition, the core definition of a human settlement is a population center of people. So you'll have some entrepreneurs, which I'm sure they're doing it already, that they're just going to buy land and then turn it into a safe parking where they can legally set it up. Now check the laws, rules, and regulations where you are for that. So in any event, that's my feel on that. We'll get more into detail as the weeks go by. We're going to open up the phone lines here. 619-768-2945 is the live stream call-in number. And hold on, before we get to the phone lines here, and matter of fact, here's a little exercise you guys can do. Whatever state that you're currently in, look up in any search engine. Population, population for the population of cities in Mississippi, or just pick whatever state you're in. And when that pops up, it'll give you, you can see how many towns that are in now how many, those lists are going to be municipal towns. So you'll find out how many municipal settlements or municipal towns in that state. That's not a whole list of everything that's in that state. That's just the ones who have a municipal corporation. But you'll see how many in there. As you get to the bottom of the list, you'll see some you'll see some towns with small numbers. As a matter of fact, if you like, you give us a call, 619-768-2945. And then let us know what some of those low numbers are. But that's the stuff I look for. Because you can essentially have more leeway. Now, and then I also mentioned these are good places if you have a business that you can set up a single industry town. You don't have to have the money bankroll like Ford or Elon Musk. There are a lot, just like these ladies that won last week. You know, they ran across an idea. I mean, they ran across a piece of land, and they practiced cooperative economics and organized in 19 families to buy that 97 acres of land. So, they gave you information on how they did that. So, okay, hold it. I can't find what I'm looking for in my studio. So, all right, let me go to. Oh, okay. Well, we'll be back in like a minute, 43 seconds, and we're gonna take phone calls. Thank you.
delight for me. Land spreading out to far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside.
New York is where I'd rather stay. I get allergic smelling hay. I just adore a penthouse view. Darling, I love you, but give me Park Avenue.
The chores.
The chores.
Fresh air.
Times Square.
You are my wife.
Goodbye, city life.
Green Acres, we are there.
And in my opinion, that's... Wait a minute. All right, we went overdrive on Green Acres. Okay, let's go to our phone lines here. 309 area code, your mic is open.
Hello, good morning. This is Chris Collins.
Good morning. Good morning. So, what's on your mind, Chris? We talked about settlements, but it's an open mic, so we can talk about anything you guys want to talk about.
Well, there should be somebody else right in the queue right behind me with a 703 area code. And if you want, you could pull him in because the partnership that we have brings food and housing, all built green, and we can do this and do this in these unincorporated areas, completely off the grid, and we can do them in town as well. So I was kind of thinking maybe
Okay, now we got more than one 703 on the board. So,
okay.
Just press one, and then I'll know which one to open the mic for. All right, I think let's go with that one. 703, they're now, your mic is open.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you clear.
Oh, great. Awesome. Thanks for that. My name is Carlos Villamar. I'm a veteran entrepreneur, electrical engineer, and patent attorney and inventor. And just hooked up with Chris and ready to take any questions or or talk about what we're doing.
All right. Sure. Great. All right. Now, Chris, give us a little direction on here. Which way are we going on this?
You know, we were talking about these towns that can be created, don't necessarily have to be incorporated to have a municipality. It's the thing about, you know, creating civilization, and not everybody wants to live in a concrete jungle. So, you know, I like the fact that, you know, you were kind of going broad with all of that. And I know that the people that are out here listening, you know, they're in town, they're out of town, but it's what else we can do by creating town. And, you know, Carlos has an amazing invention, got the patent for it, everything. He can grow fish, food, and mushrooms in the same room. And he was told, you know, it couldn't be done. And facts mean facts. And the fact is he was able to do it. And that just shows us that we can be self-sustaining completely off the grid, including our food, and it not be in the weather and all be
right.
Captured by self.
Well, you know, one thing, all right, for instance, not everybody wants to go tiny, but for those who do, and maybe the attorney can handle this. I think in the United States, 86% of the population, and for people who don't know, let me sort of like explain this or try to visualize it like a chessboard, if you can visualize a chessboard. And let's say the chessboard represents the landscape of the United States. So 86% of the population of the United States it occupies only 3% of the available amex. Now, what that looks like on a chessboard is, because the chessboard has 67 squares, 67 spaces. So what that 86% on 3% represents 4 squares on that chessboard, if I'm correct. That's it. And the rest of the empty spaces represents the balance of the United States, which is 97%, which is rural. So the United States, hands down, going away, is a rural country.
Yep.
Although 86% of the population, they live in that crammed in 3%, where you have the higher prices, you have higher crime and all that. So a lot of people aren't they don't realize what's out there. So now, and some of the things that you can do, there are things that you can do on the 97% of the land mass, which is rural, that you will not be able to do on the crammed 3%. So that's why I played the Green Acres part, because some things you're just going to have to go in the country to do. So, attorney, what are some of the things that people should consider if they want to do some of these sustainable projects?
If I could jump in just on that thought, if it's okay.
Sure.
You know, we hear, and I'm glad you mentioned what you mentioned, because we often hear, and you probably heard this, the issue with the world is overpopulation. I'm calling bullshit on that. Pardon my French. It's not overpopulation. It's the fact that everybody is crowded into the little cities is the problem. And all
You're
those
right.
resources are getting gobbled up. However, you know, we've got deserts, we've got tundras, we've got so much undeveloped land that can be developed. And that's the key, you know, is going into areas, you know, for example, let me give you an example. I lived in Lancaster, California for 6 years in the Mojave Desert. You know, there's lots of desert there, right? It's inhospitable because it's hot. However, once you put a structure like a passive solar structure that you know, can keep you cool in the summer and warm in the winter and produces soil and food, now you can start greening these deserts using permaculture principles. And this is well known. You know, there's an incredible video by a permaculturist called Jeff Lawton. The title of the video is called Greening the Desert. And he shows how he converted desert land into an oasis in a matter of 6-7 years. So the problem is not lack of land. It's lack of resources and unused resources because we're not working all the land, you know. But anyways, that's my 2 cents on that. That's very astute what you mentioned. You're 100% on point in my view.
Yeah, well, yeah, a lot of people are trying to gobble up that. I mean, they're fighting and paying all these inflated prices. And one of my primary barometers is YouTube, because, like I say, you see people by choice living in cars. We're talking about families, too. They're converting school buses and pimping them out and they learn how to grow food. Like, say, last Thursday, we had on for about an hour and 27 minutes, three ladies that, like, say, they live in metro Atlanta, but they saw this. Matter of fact, I don't know how they did. The only question that they didn't ask, and I didn't expect them to answer the question anyway, and it was all right, is how much they originally bought the land for in that part of Georgia by the acre. Because, see, now that, you know, they've got people on it and they've got things in motion, they can scale that thing and God knows make all kinds of money. But that they're not into it for the monetary thing. They're into it. They just want a safe, peaceful community and whatnot. And there are other groups out there that are doing that. But it's going to require people to develop some new skill sets and things of that nature. Matter of fact, Chris, I think you mentioned, one of the things you mentioned was growing food. I ran across something over the weekend called food sheds. People can look that up on YouTube, and they might have a Wikipedia page, food sheds, where people are, they grow food. They have a shed that they grow food out of. Some of them have it with aquaponics in it. You can set it up any kind of way you want to do it. And a lot of these things, cause where some people get caught up on this stuff, like if they want to build a tiny house or do anything with allegedly green, some cities are becoming more open-minded. But, you know, you need to check for the rules and regulations. I recommend rural areas because they're you know, I think innovation in this country and maybe probably anyplace else, if you want to find the innovators, if you want to look into the future, go to the rural areas of the country or rural areas around the world. Walmart did not start in New York City, Chicago, or Los Angeles, California. It started in Bentonville, Arkansas. And they, if you look at the Walmart map, Walmart's basically in rural areas. They're, you know, in recent years, they've come into your larger metropolitan areas. But like Washington, D.C., man, they don't want them in there. Well, they're in there now in Washington, D.C. proper. But, you know, they didn't want them in there at first. But, you know, Walmart knows the political game and landscape and all that, so they're in there right now. Now, back to the attorney. What you're in the 703 area code. That's like the D.C., the deep part of the DMV. So
I'm like 7 miles from the Washington Monument in Falls Church, Virginia. It's a suburb of Washington,
I'm
D.C.
I'm very familiar with Falls Church. I'm familiar with Falls Church, Seven Corners and all that. I'm familiar with that area.
Yep. That's where I'm at.
What are some of the things that people can do in that metro area, and what are some of the things that they can't do where they would have to go further out?
That's a good question. You know, I built the greenhouse in my backyard. It's a 10 by 20 greenhouse that I made from a carport. You know, it's a 10 by 20 carport, and it's freestanding. So the only thing keeping it on the ground is there's a bunch of gravel on the base that keeps it anchored. But other than that, it's not on a foundation. So I didn't have to pull any permits. In my understanding is here in Falls Church proper, I'm in Fairfax County. There's Falls Church City also, which probably has different regulations. But here in Fairfax County, as long as it's freestanding and you can take it apart, then you don't need to get a permit. And I also didn't want to dig a foundation and, you know, get all the electrical and all that stuff involved. So basically I just built it on top of the grass. I added some gravel as a substrate to hold the thing down. And, you know, it's a proof of concept. You know, my wife calls it the eyesore. But it's been operational for 11 years. I've got a YouTube channel called OU812 Aquaponics, where I documented the whole entire build, you know, how I built it. And the reason is that I want everybody to build these in their backyards. I will even help them. However, they are protected by patents in case people want to commercialize them. Then we have a path towards, you know, monetizing it. But I was instructed to teach everybody how to build these and to, you know, make that's why I documented everything about it. But back to your question, yeah, if you do a regular addition, like, for example, let's say I want to do one in my backyard that my wife would like. you know, now we're talking about, you know, doing a foundation and, you know, it's going to be the cost of an addition plus, you know, because we're talking about net zero construction. For those that don't know net zero, it's pretty simple. It's basically a fully insulated structure with no air leaks and no thermal bridges. And a thermal bridge is a path, you know, like let's say you put two walls right next to each other. That's a thermal bridge because when the wall outside gets cold, the inside wall gets cold. So every thermal bridge has an insulator in between it. So basically, you know, I think I've guesstimated that to build a proper version of my greenhouse in my backyard, in my neighborhood, it's going to be about 1.5 to 2.0, the regular construction costs. And the increases are due to the increased construction costs of building to net zero. And then, of course, of all the aquaponics and mushroom growing equipment that's going to go inside of it. And I'll land there.
Woo, man, Chris, there's not a big enough word beyond thank you I can think of for that, for her. And that's the thing, because the DMV is Falls Church, that's a densely populated area. Fairfax County's got like over, a million people that live in that county now?
I think it might be closer to two, perhaps.
It could be. It could be. Because that's
you know, like I drive, you know, I drive 20 minutes. I'm out in the boonies, you know, there's
okay.
Even though we're a suburb, we're not far from, you know, you start heading towards Reston and Woodbridge and those areas, there's lots
right.
of land.
Okay. Well, when you said carport, because I'm in Florida right now. So with this last, Storm Nicole that came through here like 2 weeks ago or something like that. I had a double carport. I don't have it no more. Some tree branches fell on it, and it demolished that. Didn't touch the house, thank goodness. You give me some ideas, and I love your. I wrote it down. YouTube channel OU812.
Yeah, OU812, and for the people that are, you know, I get a lot of crap over that name, believe it or not.
I'm a Van Halen person. I'm more of a Van Hagar fan, but I bought that album, OU812.
Oh, okay, well, then the fact that you know the name Van Hagar means you are a true fan, because that was the album that launched Van Hagar. That was, you know, David Lee Roth got kicked out for being a prima donna. They brought in Sammy. And this is a funny story. They wanted to call the album something, I forget the name, but one of them was out during lunch and they saw a food truck that had the serial number OU812. And he came back to the studio and said, dudes, we got to change the name of the album to OU812 because David Lee Roth had made an album, something like Eat It and Weep or something like that. It had a sexual connotation.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So they did that.
All right, well.
But yeah, that's
all right. Well, I'll be subscribing to that channel in a matter of moments. Because a lot of people in that area. Now, I used to do a lot of volunteer work in that area. Up in Tacoma Park, I did the Solar Decathlon 3 times. They used to hold it on the Washington Mall and all that type of stuff. And
welcome to some neck of the woods. I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland. My family immigrated from Ecuador when I was 6 years old to D.C.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved to the suburbs, Silver Spring, Maryland. So I know Tacoma Park, Silver Spring, all that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I got a house right in. My house is. I mean, it's empty right now, but it's the Fort Todd Metro Station. Is like 2 metro stops away from the Silver Spring. But I haven't been up there in about 3 years since the pandemic. So I heard downtown Silver Spring's really changed. But the one thing about that DMV area, there's so many areas that you can live in. But I was impressed, like say, you didn't need to pull a permit, you know, to do what you did. And that people, you know what, there are groups. Well, there's some type of sustainable group. What's that? The Sierra Club. They have Sierra clubs practically everywhere in the United. Well, not everywhere, but in many places around the United States. So I guess you can meet people like yourself and Chris in those places where if you need to find out, you know, what can you do or what can't you do when it comes to sustainability, building something, whatever, find that out. Now, let me ask you this: in a Falls Church, like. And Washington, D.C. proper, from what I understand, from a newspaper I got in here earlier this year, like with Airbnb, you can do an Airbnb in Washington, D.C. proper. However, you have to live in the property in D.C. Now, I'm in Polk County, Florida, where I'm at right now, and I don't have to live in it. So in Fairfax County, what are the rules if you want to set up an Airbnb? Because a lot of people are interested in that.
Well, you know, I should clarify that I'm a patent attorney. So I'm an electrical engineer and I have a law degree. So my field of expertise is protecting innovations, you know, inventions and things like that. So
let's switch to that.
I'm not familiar with that. And I don't want to give that
Let's go with that. Now, you have tinkerers. Well, I call them tinkerers. We have inventors or innovators. So could you, for people that don't know, what's the distinction between or difference between, patent, copyright, and trademark? Let's start with the fundamentals.
That's a wonderful question. I actually teach patent law, and all my webinars are free, by the way. So if anybody wants to learn enough to be dangerous, and let me tell you my model. I work with small inventors and startups. And the only way I can work with that group because of the high cost of getting patents is by teaching them everything that I know. So what my model is, I teach you everything that I can to have you minimize my time because I'm the most expensive part of the patenting process. But with that being said, I do have a bunch of webinars that cover this. And, you know, intellectual property is the umbrella term that includes patents, trademarks, copyrights, trade secrets, and more recently, computer and internet law, and then finally, licensing, which is how you make money from, you know, these various assets. And each one has a different level of protection. So if you think of trademark, you're thinking of brand, right? If I say to you, give me your Apple, right now, you think I'm trying to steal your phone, right? 30 years ago, you thought I wanted your fruit.
Right.
And that's a trademark. Apple spent a lot of money associating computing systems that they're making, phones and computers, et cetera, with their brand, Apple. So that now when I say Apple, you know, you're probably thinking about a phone, not the fruit. So that's a trademark. Google for search engines, Apple for computing products. So that's your brand. And trademark is something that's, you know, needed pretty much for everything. You know, whether you have a patent or not, and I'll talk about that next, you know, you always need a brand, right? You always need the marketing end of it.
Right.
And that's where the trademark comes in. Now let's talk about an easier one, copyright. A copyright is exactly what it says. It's the right to copy something. Or actually, it's the right to prevent others from copying what you did, but it only protects exactly what you did, right? So it's a work of authorship. Mm-hmm. You write a song, you make a painting, you create a digital graphic, you create a logo. You know, these are all things that you can protect through copyright. And in the United States, in order to assert a copyright, you have to register it. You don't have to register it to get the protection. But in order, if somebody's violating your copyright, then you have to register with the copyright office before you can go and have an action against that individual or company or whatever. The rest of the world, that's not required. The United States is one of the few countries that requires a copyright registration in order to go sue somebody. So copyrights only copy an exact copy of the thing, right? A song, a record, mm-hmm. an image, whatever. So you can imagine, if you created the image on your own, like let's say you created an image on your own, it's not, you get the copyright on it because you did it on your own, even though it may look similar to another image. But then you start getting, and I don't want to get too complicated in the copyright law, but there are things called derivative works, like where you take somebody else's work and make something else from it. But the bottom line is that the original author always retains a right to his work of art, his work of authorship. So that's the copyright. Finally, there's the patents. and patents protect functionality, and that's why they're more powerful. A copyright protects a specific version of a computer program, right? But a patent will protect that computer program at a very high level, at a functional level, which means it gives you much broader protection. I don't care whether you make this program in Perl or C++ or whatever language you want, as long as it meets what I have in my claims of the patent, then you're violating my patent, and then I can have you stop doing it, or I can try to collect money from you for violating the patent. One other one I didn't cover is a trade secret, and that's the Coca-Cola formula is the best example. If you can keep something secret, that's your best defense. However, reverse engineering is fair. In other words, you can't keep something secret that's easily figured out. And this is why the Coca-Cola formula is a good example. It's not easy to figure out the Coca-Cola formula, so therefore it's been kept a trade secret. And that's because when you patent something, you have to fully disclose how you're doing it. And when the patent expires, that technology enters the public domain. It gets gifted to the public. What that means is if Coca-Cola had patented their formula, it would already be in the public domain right now. Everybody would be able to make Coca-Cola. Instead, they chose to keep it a secret because they can. So those are the basic forms of protection. You've got trademarks, copyrights, patents, trade secrets, computer and internet law, and licensing, which is monetizing those assets. Sorry for the long-winded answer. And this is not legal.
No, but you gave everything was, I think, easy. You explained it, I think, where everybody can grasp it. Now, when it comes to...
I do have webinars.
Yeah,
I do have webinars that will go into more detail. I was going to say, if you this was a very shortened explanation, but I've got a 40-minute webinar.
For people that want to take advantage of that, how can they get in contact with you or through social media?
Well, last time I checked, if you do a Google search and you search LEAN, lean, and then space ITR, which stands for intellectual property rights. Last time I searched, the first three videos are mine, and my name is Carlos R. Villamar. So if you search Google, lean IPR, LEAN space IPR, India Papa Romeo, which stands for intellectual property rights, you should see, if you click on videos, you should see three videos under my name, Carlos R. Villamar. And one video covers what I just talked about, what's a patent, what's a trademark, what's a copyright, when do you search, when don't you search, how much does it cost, sort of the basic questions that people often ask me. The second webinar covers if somebody comes to you with a patent and says, hey, give me money, are you going to hand them your wallet or are you going to do a little research on your own? Well, the second webinar teaches you how to do a little research on your own so you can save money on an attorney by doing some of the legwork yourself. And then finally, the last webinar was a patent drafting workshop that I gave at the Nova Northern Virginia Community College Makerspace in Reston. And that was a patent drafting workshop, which is basically, what can you do to minimize my time so that we can get a patent filed as effectively as possible? And between those three webinars, people know enough to be dangerous. And it should also save them some money, by the way. That's why I make these webinars, is whether they use me or not is really not important. What's important is that we're making the system efficient for innovators, which is not happening right now, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask you this. All right. Let me ask you this question. It's sort of like what came first, a chicken or the egg? When I'm doing a hypothetical here, it could be Steve Jobs and Wozniak in the garage or anybody in the garage. Should you get let's start with something simple, should you get the trademark first before you do the invention? Mm-hmm. Before you have the product, or should you put the product first and then get a trademark?
These are great questions, and it's a complicated question because sometimes, as I said intellectual property is an umbrella, right? So you have to know which tools to use and when to use them, you know. So typically, you know, to patent, you know, trademark, as I said, you're always going to need. But typically, the advice I give for trademarks is see if you can get the website first, right? Because people come up with the same trademarks over and over and over again, right? So I'm going to give you an example for trademark. So I would say trademark is the most important because you're always going to need a website. You're always going to need a way of letting people know what you're doing, right? So this is what I would do if, let's say I'm starting a brand new invention, right? Let's talk about my greenhouse, okay? The greenhouse. You know, the first thing I want to do is come up with a catchy name for it that can be branded. And I'll give you an example from another client. A client of mine developed a pet toy, and he was trying to get the website pettoys.com, P-E-T-O-Y-Z.com. Well, you can imagine that was already taken, and it was already, you know, yeah, for $40,000, you can get pettoys.com. I don't know what it's worth now, but anyways, I said, well, you know, first of all, you don't want to drop 40 grand just to get a website, and second of all, that's not such a great trademark. A good trademark does not suggest the service. That's why I said Apple for computing products. That's a good trademark. Apple and computing products have nothing in common. But many people try to get trademarks that are very suggestive. So a good trademark is something that does not suggest the service. So I went to this person and I said, look, why don't you forget about pet toys? First of all, it's 40 grand. Second of all, it's not really that great of a trademark. It's a good website, but not a good trademark. I said, why don't you go back and think? And he came back with Tiny Paw, T-I-N-I-P-A-W, and he was able to get .com, .org, all of them. So now he's on to something, right? He knows that the fact that the website hasn't been taken and the fact that Tiny Paw didn't come up anywhere else on Google gives me a warm and fuzzy feeling that we're going to be able to get that trademark very quickly, and we did. So you know, I would say one of the first steps, if you're serious about what you're doing, is you're going to want to think about branding. You know, I think it's something that goes over everything. Now, when to patent or not, that's a whole other question, and that's whether you have something that can be patented, right? Some things just can't be patented. You can't patent things that already exist. You can't reinvent the wheel. Well, you can reinvent the wheel, but you can't patent the existing wheel. You can't patent an existing car. So a patent has to have novelty. And the way I describe patents, it's a novel solution to a problem. And then this leads to another question, which I get all the time, is how do I create a startup? Well, you know what? You don't create a startup. You find a problem that you're passionate about, and you solve it. And hopefully you solve it in a way that somebody else hasn't solved it, which is novel, and now you can get a patent on that. And now since you're passionate about that problem, you can create a business around it.
Woo! Man, we're going to college on this one.
You know, I teach intellectual property law to people that don't know anything about it. And it's, you know, it's my pro bono to the world. You know, there's not a lot of attorneys giving away their secrets, but I'm one of the few that believes in teaching people how to fish rather than selling them fish. And for my partners that laughed at me, you know, I was in a big law firm, and I told one of my partners, I said, hey, you know, I'm teaching people what I know to minimize my costs. And he started laughing, and he goes, I charge all my clients 40 hours for every patent application. And I said, I charge 10 startups 4 hours. What's your point? See, he didn't get the point. Mm. He was thinking short term, how to extract as much money as possible from you in the shortest period of time versus long term thinking. How can I make the process as efficient as possible so that you and I can have a long term mutually beneficial relationship where our children's children's children are working together? See, it's a different way of thinking. And I have found out, you know, the people that I've helped, they send me referrals. you know, I never look at anything as a loss. I've helped lots of inventors that couldn't afford me, and they ended up filing it on their own or whatever, and I did whatever I could to help them, you know, they sent me 50 referrals. So, you know, what did I lose? You know, what did I lose? I didn't lose anything. I just invested my time. You know, that's the way I look at it. I invest my time, and it comes back tenfold.
You're correct. Hold on a minute. We got a caller for you. 773, your mic is open.
Yes, good morning, L.A., and greeting to your guest. I've been on and off due to interference. The comment you just made, ma'am, about an idea and building something around it, could you repeat that again?
Yeah, you know, one of the questions that you always get, and I've been through this Stanford had a school called How to Start a Startup, and I went through it because I'm always trying to learn. And one of the topics they covered was that a lot of students ask, how do I create a startup? You know, and the advice was you don't create a startup, you find a problem that you're passionate about, because an invention is a novel solution to a problem. A company is a novel solution to a problem, right? Most companies exist because they're trying to solve some problem, right? McDonald's, fast food, you know, Google searching, everybody's trying to solve a problem. So if you want to start a business, find a problem that you're interested in, and that way you'll be passionate about it, and your passion will show through. You guys can tell I'm passionate about my job as a patent attorney. I love my job as a patent attorney. I love helping people. I'm also very passionate about the greenhouse I built in my backyard, because I'm telling you, I'm not a biologist, and I love biology now. I love growing fish. I love growing plants. I love growing mushrooms. I don't have all the book knowledge about it, but that doesn't stop me from doing it. You know, and I'm going off a bit on a tangent, but find a problem you're passionate about and solve it and create a business around it. That would be my advice.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to make sure that. Yes, thank you. That's one. Clear. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Chris, you had a comment? Oh, Chris, his light's on. All right, let's go to the next caller here. Sorry, I dropped my phone, but it's a sturdy phone. 314 area code, your mic is open.
You know, that's some good information. You know, one way thing that has hit the marketplace is the NFTs, non-fungible tokens, where you take a digital image of anything. And I've seen some of those images go for as much as $600,000. And I don't know if you're aware of those, but people have taken digital pictures of antique things. I had a hurdy-gurdy piggy bank. It's made out of porcelain, real pretty. I don't even remember what I'd done with it. But anyway, that thing sells. It was something given to me when I was a kid. The thing is worth over, I guess you can say, $750,000. But if you take a picture of that and then you go through the process of protecting it and so forth, then if companies or movie editors, movie producers use it, of course they have to pay you for the right to be able to use it. And some people are creating hundreds of these things that probably will show up in your sci-fi production and so on and so on and so on. So there's always new ways, means of, you know, getting into business.
Yeah, this is very true. And actually, I am very familiar with NFTs and also the blockchain. For the viewers that aren't familiar with that technology, the blockchain is basically a virtual ledger. It's a way of tracking pretty much anything in a way that can be verified cryptographically. So in other words, it gives you a way of tracking things in a way that you can prove where it came from or, you know, who created it, et cetera. So yeah, there's a lot of people selling pictures. You've probably seen these NFTs, the Bored Apes and these other ones that are selling for quite a bit of money. My own opinion on NFTs is I think they're killing the planet. You know, they're using a lot of energy for generating pictures. However, we are considering doing NFTs for impact projects. In other words, where when the person buys the image, the money goes towards an impact project like the Greenhouse Project or Feed the Vets or Feed the Home, you know, some sort of impact. And that's, I think, is a good use for the NFTs. And in fact, there's a lot of money that was made in that space, and there's a lot of people in that space looking to invest that money in projects that help Mother Earth, impact projects. So I think it's a wonderful technology. I think a lot of the ways it's been used, I'm not real crazy about, you know, just making money. But you know, I think it has some good applications. And, of course, it made money for people that didn't have money, right? So that's also a good thing. You know, it is a way of creating wealth. But it is interesting technology. It's Web 3.0, by the way. It's the next, you know, everything is going to be blockchain. Blockchain is the new .com, basically.
Yeah, WB 3.0. And the blockchain is a great thing. And the thing that I like about it is that your private key is your private key, no matter what exchange a network is used on. And you can put it in your pocket through what's called a cold wallet. I myself involved in those activities, and they're very lucrative. But as in anything, the big G word comes in, and that's greed. And you have problems with rug pull, just like what we're seeing in the news today with FTX. And Sam, I can't think of his first name. What is his first name? Sam Banks Freed. He's in the news today for the things that's been going on using the dark side of the blockchain. Or should I say cryptocurrency? Okay, LA, where you go?
No, I had myself muted.
I got caught up in the conversation. But attorney, continue on. Yeah, I was on mute. I'm off mute now.
What's the name of your what's the name of your company again, sir? I'm looking for a good patent attorney. My last one died from COVID.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you can find me very easily by my last name, .com, and I'm going to give you – I'm going to give everybody a mnemonic device so you will always be able to find me. My last name is Villamar. It's V-I-L-L-A-M-A-R, and it actually means villa by the sea in Spanish, Villamar. So it means villa by the ocean. I try to get Villamar.com, and it's a resort in Mexico. So I couldn't get my own name as a website, which was very sad. But then I realized that my wife works with me in my law firm. She does contracts and copyrights and trademarks. I do patents. And I realized there was two of us. I was able to get villamars.com. And this is a mnemonic device. Is I'm going to put a picture in your mind. And if you can remember this picture, you can always find me. Picture a villa on the planet Mars, villamars.com. So V-I-L-L-A-M-A-R-S.
Yeah, a little
V
slower, please.
Yeah, V as in Victor, I as in India, L as in Lima, A as in Alpha, M as in Motel, A as in Alpha, R as in Romeo, S as in Sierra, Villa Mars, V-I-L-L-A-M-A-R-S. Picture a villa on the planet Mars, and you will always be able to find me.
Yes. You know, I found out this, if you're going to do business, you got to have two key people, or actually more than that, but two of them. You need to have a good patent attorney, and also you have to have a good custom agent in order to get things done in other countries. So, unfortunately, like I said, my last patent attorney passed away from COVID. So,
I'm sorry,
I may be contacting. Yeah.
Well, I had COVID, and it sucks. It hit me for about a good 2 weeks. I had the joint aches, the whole enchilada. But I'm better now. I don't plan on dying anytime soon, but you never know, right?
Well, you know the old saying, I'm too young to the 80-year-old man. He's too young to die, and he's too slow to run, so you have to sit there and fight it.
Well, I'm right behind you, brother. I'll be 64 this February. So,
yeah, well, you're a kid.
Yeah, I got two kids.
Yeah, 64, you're still a kid.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing, you know, you're always a kid, right? Like, I still feel like the 3-year-old kid that I was, which is weird. I don't feel like I've changed at all, to tell you the truth, which is good. I'm still that child, you know. Why did I build that thing in my backyard? I always liked building things. As a kid, I used to build model cars. I used to build airplanes. You know, I'm a true engineer. So when I saw that, you know, you're telling me the fish feed the plants and the plants feed the fish, I was like, how cool is that? You know, I mean, how cool is it to have your own little, you know, ecosystem? And as soon as I saw that infographic on Facebook in 2012, I went, you know, and this is the way I operate. I research, I plan, and I execute. And I don't go back. Like, I don't go back to, once I'm done with research, I'm done with research. Now I'm in the planning stage. Once I'm done with the planning stage, I'm in execution mode. And this way I'm able to execute very quickly. I saw the infographic on December. I had the system up and running in March in my backyard. I take action.
What field do you have engineering degree in? You said electrical engineer?
Yeah, my background is electrical engineering, computer science. I do anything electromechanical. I'll do, biological systems also, but I won't really do chemical stuff like chemistry. I've taken chemistry, but it's just not interesting to me. I could do it, but, you know, I get to choose to work with what I like to work with. So I like to work with technology that's interesting to me.
You know, when I was younger, I used to be an electronic hobbyist coming off of the background of being an extra class ham radio operator. I built all my equipment.
No.
And I got into the business of building. I built robots that had ultrasonic detectors, infrared detectors. When it felt that its battery was going down through its logic system, I had a charging station connected to a receptacle in the wall.
You sure know how to get me interested, brother.
It bagged itself up to the charging station. Yeah, it bagged itself up to the charging station and charged itself.
Okay.
I had a computer-operated van, and believe it or not, I built a trip computer, one that would tell you your ETA, miles per gallon, and all those things. And I utilized electronics, especially a 16-segment display that I got from the company in Texas, Liltronic. You know, those companies will give you their latest in innovations to hobbyists. They give it to them free.
Yep. You know, when I was a electrical engineering student, of course, all of the sales reps are contacting you from like Texas Instruments, from National Semiconductor, you know, because they know when you graduate, you know, they want you familiar with their hardware, because what are you going to do? You're going to order their hardware, and it actually works. I was into signal processing. And I got some chips from Texas Instrument. At the time, these chips were like freaking $20,000 a chip. And sending me samples. But then when I graduated and went to Hughes Aircraft and we built the first software-defined radio, guess which signal processing chips I used? They got their money back, brother, because we ended up putting six of them on one board, and those were paid for.
My basement was a laboratory. I built my TV, that remote control, and all those goodies. And funny thing about that TV, when I went to first turn it on, I got a long broomstick to hit the on-off switch because I didn't want to be near it when it exploded. But it didn't. It worked out. But, you know, that's the difference between now and then. Then I had an electronic surplus store called Gateway Electronics. I could go in there and buy, you know, transistors, TTLs, and all sorts of things. And they don't have that today for young people, where their imagination become intuitive. And also your garage, believe it or not, I had a foreman when I first started off in my trade. His son-in-law and another guy was building computer wafer chips in their garage using these dangerous chemicals. Yeah, they would come up with burns on the arm and everything else.
You should explain, you know, let me explain, you know, what you just said. Building custom chips in your garage is super, super high level, okay? Because, like, we had a whole entire lab at Hughes Aircraft with scientists and stuff and clean rooms, you know, for building these super custom chips. And somebody do it in the garage. That's incredible.
Yes.
And
everything comes out of the garage. Everything seemingly start off in a basement or a garage. And you could turn a garage into, I mean, anything. When you look
at my backyard, you know, if you go to
Spider-Man,
my YouTube channel, you'll see my, you know, the greenhouse I built in my backyard. And it worked great.
Look at the lightsabers that uses. Look at the lightsabers that's used in Star Wars. That was a garage experiment. Spider-Man web that he shoots out of his hand, that was a garage experiment also. So, you know, a lot of things comes out of intuitive minds if you give them a garage with a drill press and a saw and stand back and look out.
Yeah, you know, that's why those maker spaces are so incredible. And something that I want to mention about the tiny houses and what I'm doing with Chris, you know, bringing this stuff to the schools is super, super important. You know, that greenhouse that I have in my backyard is an entire STEM lab. It has everything in it. It's got biology. It's got taking care of fish, plants, mushrooms. It's got mechanical because, you know, you're talking about construction, civil, architecture. You can bring in the kids that write apps. You know, you could add sensors and apps and, you know, it really is, you know, I would love to see, you know, what I'm trying to do with my greenhouses. And by the way, there's somebody from Arizona State University on the line, Nick Ledbetter. He's a graduate student from their entrepreneurial division. And he's partnered with me to try to help with the greenhouses, you know, marketing and selling them. But one of my main goals is to get connected with schools, to bring these greenhouses to the schools and to get the kids learning about taking care of fish, plants, mushrooms, you know, about passive solar design, about net zero design, and all, you know, because we're going to need this, you know, and these are skills that are going to be, I think, very, very important over the next few years.
Well,
that's where I was going.
If I was to come back and do it again, you know, matter of fact, you talk about the growing. I turned my living room into a botanical where I grew all sorts of things, had plants hanging from the ceiling, and my wife was really pissed. But if I was to come back today, I would work on anti-gravity, that type of innovation that would be able to propel vehicles from the ground straight on up into, you know, into outer space without using any liquid or solid rocket fuel like we have today. I have to take my hat off to SpaceX and also to Tesla with their ability and what they have done with those heavy lift rockets where they can come back and land on the pad vertically. That there is, that is just astonishing. And within that, you can see a lot of homing devices that's used with your drones. Drones is another innovation that it just has so many possibilities that it just baffles the mind.
We got another call here, area code 602. 602 Erico, your mic is open.
Hey, this is Nicholas Ledbetter, the guy he was just talking about from ASU. Just graduated Master's of Science in Innovation and Venture Development, where I started my own startup, had my own invention problems, and was approaching Carlos for help, and he kind of pulled me into the project. I'm super passionate to be here and connecting it to the communities here. We're having food sustainability issues and water issues, and his device is, like, perfect for desert environments.
Well, that name Ledbetter is, to me, is familiar. I knew a Ledbetter. I just can't picture him right now, but that's a great adventure that you're involved in. It's something that's needed, like I was telling the other gentleman, and he was talking about. It's absent from schools nowadays. You know, when I was a kid, I used to take the TV apart and had to get it back together before my grandfather came back from work. And I would always have problems with those capacitor tubes because they would shock the hell out of you. But no, that was because I had an inquisitive mind. And there's a lot of inquisitive minds out there today that need to hook up with people like you and your friend.
Yeah, we're actually pulled on a couple of engineering students and one designer to help us do some of the startup development and start kind of testing some early concepts to get some feedback and develop the product right.
And maybe you know, the technology. I'm sorry, go ahead, sir.
I did want to mention that we are going to be having a Kickstarter, and sorry for pitching on it, but anyways, it'll be announced, and you guys know how to get a hold of me, but we are going to be having a Kickstarter for the Dream Habitat greenhouses. And, you know, more importantly, I cannot wait to get with Chris and our 3D guy. We have an incredible 3D graphics artist from the Czech Republic. He's the one that captured our greenhouses, you know, the schematics of them. And actually, we have a version that you can go actually walk through, you know, with a computer. And you can actually go in there with VR if you had that. But anyways, I'm really looking forward to getting with getting with Chris and seeing what his capabilities are with the tiny homes that he's building and seeing how we can quickly adapt that technology to these greenhouses so that we can start, putting these out there. We do have a version of the greenhouse already that could be built, but I wanted to see how maybe we can integrate with what Chris is doing.
And, you know, you can use technology has been around for quite some time. Military using also smaller scale is the ability to take water out of the air, especially humidity. And you don't have to depend on well water. You don't have to depend on the rain either.
We're looking at all that stuff. You know, the greenhouses themselves are desalinators. You know, and you guys that are military or survivalists, know about the concept of making a water still. You know, it's a way of generating water. Basically, you dig a hole in the ground and you put a piece of plastic in it over top of it. And then assuming there's some water in the hole, when it evaporates, it condenses onto the plastic. And you stick a little rock in the middle of the plastic, so now it makes like a cone. And underneath that cone, you hang a cup. And all that condensation collects on the plastic and drips into the cup. And it's a survival technique for generating water. These greenhouses, since the front of the greenhouse is all glass, that front of the greenhouse is actually can work as a solar still. So if you put them over salt water, for example, they will start generating drinking water.
And or connect them to desert wells.
Say again?
My research connecting them to desert wells solves a big issue for the farmers here.
Yeah, you could even connect it to brackish water or even polluted water. You could add some swampland and some banana trees and some coconut trees, and then you could start generating fresh water.
No, I thought about some.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we used to camp out on sandbars and we have, of course, you know, it's sand. We dig a hole in the wet sand and put our bottles of soda in there, cover it up, and take Coleman lantern fluid and pour on top and light it. After it burns out, you dig up your bottles. They frosty. They cold. It's like you pour in a refrigerator.
That's very cool. You know, I should mention part of the technology that's novel on these greenhouses, and the reason why I'm very anxious to work with Arizona State University and literally any places that have arid environments, these greenhouses are perfect. Think Lancaster, California, Mojave Desert, think parts of Texas, Arizona, Colorado, et cetera. And it's because at the top of the thermal battery, which is a component of these passive solar greenhouses, you have to have a way of storing that solar energy, and we use a thermal battery, which is nothing more than a wall filled with water painted black, you know, so it stores the heat energy. At the top of the water wall, we put an evaporative cooling system so that now the greenhouse, it's very yin and yang. There's the dark side and the light side. There's the hot side and the cold side. There's the CO2 side and there's the O2 side. There's the humid side and there's the dry side. It's very, very yin and yangish. And the greenhouse actually generates its own climate where the hot oxygen rises in the plant chamber, gets captured by the evaporative cooler, and that cold, moist air gets pushed into the mushroom chamber. And now all that CO2 from the mushroom production gets pushed back into the plant chamber and completing the cycle. So you get hot air and cold air being cycled. You get CO2 and O2 being cycled, and you get dry and humid air being cycled all within the greenhouse. And that's what allows you to have the different microenvironments, you know, one for the plants, one for the mushrooms. And of course, the fish are in the middle. They can go to the light side or the dark side, just like humans. You know, we can go to the dark side or the light side of the greenhouse. So
hey,
I've
seen those same type of a stone masses used in greenhouses where you heat them up during the day with the violet rays of the sun. Then at night it releases heat that you can use to heat the structure, heat the house. And also you mentioned water walls. Those have been incorporated in that same fashion in homes too.
Like in fact, you know, let me tell you what was inventive, you know, because I'm a patent attorney and I've got patents on this. The concept of a passive solar greenhouse is called an earthship, is called a Chinese solar greenhouse, has been known for hundreds of years. Okay, the concept of digging a hole, covering it in plastic, putting some thermal batteries inside of it, gallons, you know, 55-gallon barrels painted black full of water, that's a thermal battery. You know, putting that in the back of the hole, the Chinese were growing food with 4 feet of snow outside. I saw that technology and I said, this is really cool. You know, here's people with no technology at all, no modern technology, growing food with 4 feet of snow outside. I said, this is really, really cool. So I decided to build my own version of a passive solar greenhouse using a 10x20 carport. I did a 10x20 carport with 2-inch thermoshield. I used a 300-gallon jacuzzi as my fish tank. You know, I used a bunch of 30-gallon totes as my grow beds. I used some 4-inch and 1-inch PVC for doing all my plumbing and my for pushing the water and the air. And then everything runs off of little air pumps. Every grow bed has its own air pump, and every grow bed can be run off of its own little solar panel. And you know, if you visit my OU812 aquaponics YouTube channel and you go back, like search winter or whatever, you'll see videos of me walking out there with 4 feet of snow outside, minus 10 degrees, right? And I go inside my greenhouse and it's like 90, the fish are swimming, the mushrooms are growing, and the plants are growing. There is not a better feeling on earth. There is not a better feeling. It's something about it being cold outside and you being warm around plants, fish, and mushrooms. I cannot describe the feeling. I can spend hours and hours and hours in that greenhouse. This weekend, we're going to be shooting the first part of my Kickstarter video from my greenhouse. A friend of mine's a photographer. He's coming over to shoot the video. And it's just going to be me talking, you know, in my greenhouse, And I'm just going to tell you what I got, you know, how I came up with it. You know, it's, you know, I can't lie. I'm not a good salesman. I can only tell the truth, you know, and the truth is that I stumbled into aquaponics and I love it, you know, and now that I'm growing fish plants and mushrooms, and now that I've hooked up with Chris with a project that's super near and dear to my heart, I'm a veteran, okay? You know, I've got two buddies of mine that are KIA. I've got veterans, you know, 7 miles from my house sleeping on the street in Washington, D.C., in the richest fucking country on earth, pardon my French. This mm-hmm. is not acceptable. This is not acceptable. This
yeah,
is not
you're
acceptable.
Absolutely right. You know
and
something
curable.
Else that was – you know something else that's innovative, too. If you bit out the pipes and interlace them in your backyard
yes.
about 4 feet down, 5 feet down, and you pull air into – you pull that air
yes.
for your furnace intake. Well, what are you doing?
Yep.
That temperature there is about 60 degrees all year long.
Yep.
So you're taking
air
and raising the temperature from 60 to 70 or 75, which is ideal for your house,
right.
rather than taking outside air, which is below zero. You use
mm-hmm.
a whole lot of energy of covering that distance. So there's a lot of things mm-hmm. that could be done. They're just not being done.
No, they're not, you know, and this is the thing, you know, right now with today's technology, with what I got in my backyard, I can build an off-grid house that feeds people organic fish plants and mushrooms all year round. Why are we not doing this? You know, you guys want to build one? Go to my YouTube channel. It's not complicated. It's a freaking 10x20 carport with 2-inch thermoshield, you know. Some triple pane polycarb, a jacuzzi, some air pumps plugged into the grid.
Yeah.
You know, I could build one of these if I had the parts right now, and the parts all together I think are around $6,500 for the 10x20, and that's gone up because of COVID, right? Because of the shipping and everything has doubled.
Mm-hmm.
I think back in the day I probably paid around $3,000 for all that stuff, but now it's around $6,000 because of the pandemic. However, you know, now that I built one, I could probably build one with probably would take me and maybe one other person or maybe two people at most. I could probably put one up, and this is something I want to try to see how quickly I could put one of mine up. Now that I know how to do it, right, the hard part is always the first time, right, when you're figuring everything out. But once you figured it out, you know, it's not that difficult, you know, and I think I could probably put one up in probably under 10 hours, I would say 10 hours max. And mostly because, you know, there's some aquaponics stuff, you know, you got to fill up the, you know, there's some other stuff that goes into it. But yeah, you know, I'm so excited about being on the show. First of all, thanks to Chris Collins, who's doing, he's with Hope, and he's, you know, he's building tiny homes for the homeless. And we've partnered together to build tiny homes for the homeless that feeds them fish, plants, and mushrooms. And what I don't know which caller that was talking. I don't know what your name is. I'm Carlos. What you're talking about is like all that stuff can be incorporated. What he was talking about last was geothermal. Geothermal is the concept of using the underground, you know, if you like right here in Falls
yeah.
Church, if you go down 6 feet, the ground is always 65 degrees all year round. So the point that
yeah,
he was making is why would you take hot air and cool it when you can take cool air and cool it, or better yet, not even cool it. You know, like if you design geothermal properly, you don't even need
mm-hmm.
a fan. You can use the chimney effect. In other words, if you take an 8-inch pipe, you know those black pipes you've seen in construction. I don't know what they're used for
mm-hmm.
actually. I think they're used for running water or whatever. If you take one of those pipes in a U shape, right, that goes down 6 feet and comes back up, and you make one end bigger than the other, hopefully the end that's in the hot side, it will naturally suck the cold air. It will naturally suck the cold air out of the ground and pump it into your greenhouse, and it'll also go the other direction. When the green, you know,
yeah.
it'll cool the greenhouse. And also, when the greenhouse is cold, it'll suck that 65-degree temperature up, and 65 is better than 30, right? That's the whole point of it. 65 is better than 30.
Bianchi, I got to interrupt. We got the time. We got another call here, 309. Area code 309-7006. The mic is open. Area code 309-706. Mic's open.
Hey, guys, how are we doing today?
Great.
Doing great.
Good, good.
Wonderful.
Great topics, by the way. This is Mark Marshall, friends with Chris, and great to know everybody here today. As far as geothermal and aquaponics, tying those two together, questions as far as, you know, the water, having that water turnover or having that air turnover, you're talking about a black side and a light side. What's the correlation of that, and how does that play, and slow down a little bit in your explanation, but explain how that plays into being able to have CO2 versus O2, vice versa, and how does that work with the water? How is all that environment working together, if you don't mind?
Okay, that's a great question. First of all, the water wall, and I should probably change the name. I use thermal battery, but it confuses people. So I've been using the term water wall, which also confuses people because they think it's a wall of water. Actually, it's a container filled with water. Now, it could be a 55-gallon barrel, as the Chinese do, or as anybody could do, painted black. And this is just basic thermodynamics, right? If you take a container full of water painted black and you stick it in the sun, it's going to get hot, and that heat is going to get stored in the water as thermal energy and slowly dissipated later on as the temperature goes down. So when the temperature is hot, it's storing energy. When the temperature goes down, it's releasing energy. So that's one component of the greenhouse, is the thermal battery. And just think of it as a wall of water painted black, not moving, not doing anything. Okay? That's the thermal battery.
Makes
now,
sense.
What other water do you
that
have?
Water, that water just sits there. It doesn't circulate. It just sits there and stores energy, releases that energy when it's cold, stores it when it's warm.
So that's the basic component of a passive solar design, is a thermal battery or a thermal mass. It could be a water-filled wall, or it could be the side of your house. If you build one of these off of the side of your house facing south, guess what? You've got a thermal mass. It's called your house. You know, it'll store all that energy. So anyways, that's another component of the greenhouse, is the water wall. And think of the water wall as dividing the greenhouse into two sections, a light side and a dark side. Why is there a light side? Because the structure is facing south, and the south is all glass, right? So that's the light side. Then you have the water wall, which is which is collecting the light, so it's blocking the light, right? So on the other side of the water wall, you have the dark side, the shaded side. Now, what light shade? Mushrooms. That's how I stumbled into that design, was that I built my greenhouse, right? And I had 6 grow beds, 3 on the front, 3 on the back. The ones in the back weren't operating very well because they weren't getting any light. And I kept trying to grow, you know, vegetables that don't require it all. It just wasn't working very well. And then one day I was just sitting there and I go, I had done mycology 5 years earlier. I said, I know what grows in the dark, mushrooms. So I started experimenting with growing mushrooms aquaponically. And I was told by all the experts that it would never work. And it worked very, very well. So the way it works is, you've got this greenhouse. You've got the light side where the glazing is. And the glazing, by the way, is at the perfect angle for the winter solstice sun. The winter solstice sun is coming up. And it's when the sun is at the lowest point in the sky. When the sun is at the lowest point in the sky, you want the glazing to make a 90-degree angle with the sun, so that all of that solar energy gets captured by the thermal battery, the water wall. In the summertime, When the sun is high up in the sky, the water wall is shaded, and it works in reverse. It keeps the greenhouse cool. So in the wintertime, it's collecting solar energy, keeping the greenhouse warm. In the summertime, it's in the shade, keeping the greenhouse cool. So now we understand that there's a light side and a dark side, right? A water wall dividing the light side from the dark side. Well, what likes the light? Plants. Plants produce oxygen. What likes the dark? Fish and mushrooms. Fish and mushrooms produce CO2, just like humans do. So now when you add that evaporative cooling system at the top of the water wall, you can now cycle hot air and cold air, moist air and dry air, CO2 and O2. And you can also build houses that way because humans also produce CO2. So I hope that answered the question.
I designed a house, and I had a sunroom on the southern exposure, and the slab was 1 foot thick, and I had the slab on sand. And in the sand, I had a sheet metal 8-inch diameter pipe that ran through the sand to the front end of the sunroom, and it terminated in the basement. And during the day, that slab would heat up, and of course, the sand would help store the heat, and it was transferred into the pipe. And on the inside of the pipe in the basement, I would have about a 600 CFM fan that would take that heat out of the sunroom and was stored in the slab and help use the heat the house at night. Well, during the daytime, in the summertime, the basement is always cooler than every other part of the house. So I would just reverse it, take the cool air out through the sunroof and have vents up at the top of it that come into the house to help cool down the house.
That's a thermal battery, brother. That is a thermal battery. You had just described a thermal battery. It's a way of exchanging hot and cold air. And you can do it, you know, many, many ways. And the beauty of it is you can stack these things. In other words, you can build a greenhouse that has the water wall, that has the geothermal, that has the thermal battery in the ground. And they all stack on top of each other to make it even more and more and more efficient. A properly designed net zero house can be heated with a tiny little stove because it's so well insulated.
Yeah, yeah,
it's the same
right.
way igloos work, right? Igloos, right? How do Eskimos survive in minus 50 degrees? They build an igloo, right? It cuts the wind, and it's insulated. And, you know, the walls are like about a foot and a half thick. You know, they're huge chunks of ice. So you're talking about a super well-insulated structure enclosed. Well, it's going to contain heat. And that's, you know, that's how igloos work. And that's how this greenhouse works at a high level. You know, it's a fully insulated structure with a thermal battery. I should say thermal batteries, right? Because as you just pointed out, in my greenhouse, I have multiple thermal batteries. I've got the grow beds. They're all black. I've got the 300-gallon fish tank that's got, you know, 300 gallons of water. And I've got all my gravel on the floor. You know, so all of that is a thermal mass that's keeping the energy inside that greenhouse. I don't have a water wall in it right now because I didn't build it in this one. But I do have the mushroom section blocked off with black plastic paper that separates the mushroom section from the plant section. But if you go to my YouTube channel, you can see what I'm talking about. And there's even videos that explains how the technology works from a schematic point of view. Like I said, I filed patents on it, so you can look me up on Google Patents, and you can even read the patents if you want.
Yeah, that thermal wall could be made out of plexiglass tubes, by the way, which is not expensive.
Yeah, you know, we're thinking about, you know, sustainable ways of doing it. And one of the ways I'm thinking is how cool would it be to make the water wall from bamboo, you know, where you just grow a bunch of bamboo and you fill it with water, you cap it off and you paint it black. Now you've got a natural water wall. that is eventually biodegradable.
You can get bamboo up to about 6-8 inch diameter too, by the way, right there in Florida.
Yeah, you can. I was actually thinking of a tropical design that would probably work in Florida if you have access to bamboo, where you grow the entire mm-hmm. frame out of bamboo, right? Say, picture like you make the outline of the frame in bamboo, and then you mm-hmm. pour mud on the inside of it. Now you've got a bamboo wall filled with mud. I imagine the R value has got to be like 50 something or something outrageous. You know, now you've got your fully insulated structure, right? For the glazing, I had an idea that I haven't tried yet. What if you collected a shit ton of 1 liter bottles?
Yeah, people do that.
Yeah, and glued them all together, right? And made your glazing out of that. You would have a pretty well insulated glazing because, you know, these liter bottles are what, about 12 inches long, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So now you're talking about a way of recycling all these liter bottles that are just going to go to dumps, you know, to dumps, and creating greenhouses out of them. And there are people that have built entire greenhouses just from plastic bottles, by the way. So you could actually build what I did, you know, this is the beauty of this technology. There's a million ways to build it. The technology is not how do I put this? The important part of it is understanding the concept. How you actually build it is up to you, if that makes sense.
Those water wall designs, you could use that in a 5-story building.
Yeah,
the same principle.
I think it's time to mention the skyscraper version.
A 5-story building, one wall, your southern exposure wall is the water wall, and you have just a CFM up on the top, which is circulating that warm air back down through the building and help heat it. And the major part of producing the heat is being produced by the sun, so you don't have to use natural gas. You don't have to use any alternative fuel, just the sun.
Nope. And then look, if you want to go 100% natural, you know, you don't have to have aquaponics in there. You don't have to have air pumps. The Chinese were growing food with no technology. Literally, it was a hole in the side of a mountain with a bunch of barrels in the back covered in plastic. And at night, they would put a blanket over the plastic. I mean, talk about low tech, you know, no electricity, nothing. And they would grow their plants inside of that hole, and they would manually water it, you know. So,
and on a low-tech, we're offering one on the crowdfunding side for a perk for $500 to help boost the project. You should mention the countertop version.
we're having this Kickstarter, and, you know, I want to get people started on growing, you know, mushrooms, plants, and fish. So we have one of our perks at the $500 donation level is a miniature greenhouse for growing microgreens and mushrooms. Now, a lot of people have asked me why I didn't add the fish, and there's actually a method to my madness. The fish are the hardest part. Okay, so I can get you growing mushrooms and microgreens very, very easily because mushrooms and microgreens are very forgiving, generally speaking. Fish are life forms you can kill very easily without doing proper water chemistry. They require some expertise. So the plan of attack that I have for people that want to transition in aquaponics, you know, they want to do fish, plants, and mushrooms, I'll say, look, let's see if you can grow mushrooms and plants. Okay, you're able to grow mushrooms and plants. Let's see if you can keep goldfish alive for a half a year. You know, get yourself
you know,
a small fish tank.
Have you ever heard of Will Allen?
Of who?
Have you ever heard of a guy by the name of Will, W-I-L-L-A-L-L-E-N, former NFL football player? And he does this up in Chicago. Yeah, he has an aquaponic farm right in the city of Chicago. It may be Milwaukee, one of the two. But he's been doing it for a long time. Aquaponics, growing fish, the dirty water off the fish is used to feed the plants and comes back around and replenish the wall. Yeah, he's been doing it for quite some time.
Well, if you have a connection to him, I can add mushrooms. and I got to tell you, the mushrooms are the star of the show, by the way. I'll tell you why.
Yeah, look up his name, Will Allen. He had people coming from all over the world visiting his place, doing seminars and explaining what he was doing. They take that information back home and make an application out of it.
Well, I would love to connect with people like that. But, what's interesting with what I did is I integrated mushrooms with aquaponics. And that's a really interesting combination because the mushrooms, let me give you some numbers. 1 square foot of mushroom production area generates 10 pounds of mushrooms per week. Those mushrooms sell for about $10 to $15 a pound. And they're also high in protein, high in nutrition, medicinal, et cetera. So the mushrooms, I believe that the mushrooms is what would allow one human to live in a 10 by 20 all year round. The combination of the mushrooms plus the fish and the plants. And in fact, the mushrooms are going to be the stars of the diet. They're going to be the most prolific, out of everything you produce, the mushrooms are going to be producing faster than anything. But the beauty of mushrooms is, hello, vegans. people that don't eat meat, guess what they eat? Mushrooms and vegetables. So the mushrooms are a really super important component of the whole project, also because they're incredible composters, and they generate this biologically rich soil. So the mushrooms, all the waste from the greenhouse can be converted into mushrooms. The mushrooms convert that into soil, and the soil you can put into your garden. And there's also some composting systems using black soldier flies and worms so that nothing in the greenhouse gets wasted, nothing. Like all the food that we generate here, all the food waste goes right back into the compost and gets reprocessed into soil.
And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you have a patent application on like an auto feed system where your composter, some of the worms and the bugs, along with like the mushrooms and the plants you're growing, could feed the fish, and it actually does create a waste nutrition closed loop cycle between all three.
Yeah, that's right. The black soldier flies are incredible human food. Well, they're incredible chicken feed, fish feed, and even human feed. You could eat black soldier flies yourself if you can get over eating, grubs. But yes,
else you can do with this dirty fish water? You can use it in the hydroponic production of fodder that cattle and chicken eat.
One of my favorite feedbacks was. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, Rick. Now, as you say, you can also generate biogas from it.
Ms. Dillon, give your that YouTube address again. We don't want to miss all this you got started up. The YouTube address again.
YouTube address?
OU812,
I think,
isn't it?
Yeah, OU812 Aquaponics.
The letter O, the letter U, the numbers 812, and then Aquaponics. It's also on Facebook. There's an OU812 Aquaponics on Facebook and YouTube. The Facebook channel has actual drawing. It has photos of when I built the greenhouse. The YouTube channel has videos, but the Facebook channel has better – well, it has more detailed information regarding, the actual build of the greenhouse. But I'm also on Clubhouse. If you find Dream Habitat on Clubhouse for the Clubhouse listeners, I know several – I think – Our host is on Clubhouse also, I believe.
Every day.
I have a Dream Habitat. Oh, by the way, I'm transmitting this right now in our lounge, our Dream Habitat lounge. We have a Dream Habitat club and a Dream Habitat lounge. And right now my computer in the basement is transmitting this in the lounge. So we're getting a little
great
broadcasting.
So you mentioned the OU812 Facebook. But the Facebook for the project is the Dream Habitat Project.
Yeah, and let me explain that. OU812 Aquaponics was the original brand that I had, you know, and then Dream Habitat was the brand that we came up with for the greenhouses because people didn't like OU812 for some reason. So we changed it to Dream Habitat for the greenhouses.
They just remind me.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you can do with hydroponics. That's producing that fodder for cow and chicken is just one. You can also do wheatgrass that has nutritional value for human beings. A lot of things.
No, there is. And, you know, the beauty of these, you know, like people throw the word sustainable around quite a bit. The true definition of sustainable, very few people meet. Sustainable means requires no inputs and generates no harmful outputs. That's truly sustainable. It requires no inputs and it doesn't do any harm to Mother Earth. That's true sustainability.
You know, even,
and the thing
in,
about
your, even in your tiny home, you can use put down a water seal on top of the roof. The sheeting, then you could put moss,
yep,
plain old moss,
yep,
on top of that, and that would keep that house cool in the summertime. And the,
yep,
moss will keep growing,
you know,
just like it does on a rock.
No, beautiful. I was in a clubhouse room the other day with somebody from Denmark or Norway, where they showed an image of this entire library that's underground and the whole top is grass. It's like, it's basically inside of a grass hill. You know, how beautiful, fully insulated, you know, easy to maintain roof. You know, what an incredible.
Yeah, and the temperature protects the books.
Yes.
So there's a lot of things that could be done naturally. It's marketable to, of course, it's not broadly marketable, but it can be marketable to a small populace, and you know, it could spread. You know, we talk about the Sahara Desert. Well, if we have concerns about the atmosphere, just grow trees in the Sahara Desert. It probably would cut down on the number of hurricanes that come this way from West African coast too.
Oh, definitely. You know, once we start greening the deserts, people have a misconception about the desert. Deserts are highly nutritious. You know, that sand is made of fossils. You know, it's super, super nutritious. So the problem isn't lack of nutrition in the desert. The problem is that nothing can stick to it. You know, you've got winds blowing, so all that nutrition is just being blown around. It doesn't have a place to settle. Once you start putting soil on the sand, now those nutrients have a place to settle. Once you add soil, you start bringing in water. Once you bring in water, you bring in creatures. And pretty soon these things become oases. You know, water comes, the animals start coming, and next thing you know, you've got a habitat. And also you're fighting, you know, global warming because we need, you know, we need more green areas to take in the carbon.
Do you want to go to a meeting tomorrow, 2 o'clock?
Yeah, one of the reasons why that contributes to global warming, energy warming, is paved surfaces. You got parking lots. You got these centers where you can go to the shopping malls. You got all that expansive acres and acres of paved, sometimes blacktop concrete. Paved surfaces that reflects the sunlight. It's just like when you go in the city at night, it's hot. You go out into the rural area, it's cool. It's because those concrete, and especially the road surfaces, absorbs that heat and gives it off at night. Now, if they came up with some impervious road surfaces that would allow water, rainwater, to penetrate through and refurbish the water tables underground, and that will solve a lot of the problems. But right now, you take that water, rainwater runoff, you channel it in a drain, in a sewer, and you deposit it in the river, and it's not having the opportunity to replenish the underwater water table like it was designed to do.
And we have the solutions. I was in a room the other day where they were talking about, they said, who do you think is going to solve these problems? You know, whether it's going to be government or private industry or organizations or whatever. And I said, it's going to take we, the people. We're going to have to solve our own problems. You know, I hate to say it, but it's going to take us.
Government's not going to do it. Government's going to develop. Private people and the common man and female that does the development with their ideas, unlimited knowledge, unlimited dreams that they have in their mind. That's what brings about the further advancement of humankind.
I'd also say, like, commercials having a hard time scaling up to deal with how many people and how many hungry mouths there are. So we really need to flip that whole carbon footprint that's associated with commercial farming and grow locally and start providing for ourselves and our communities.
Well, that would take a re-education, changing their lifestyles in order to achieve that feeding large populations. And it would be a chore. But it can start small first and then spread.
Yeah, we're starting with just trying to reconnect people with nature and getting them to be their own growers, growing their own life again.
And you have to do that with young children. You can't take a person my age and tell them to get out there and dig a garden. I ain't going to do it. But you got to start that with young children and get them into acclimated into the mindset. And then hopefully they will carry that on into their adult life where they will allow for time to be able to implement that and maintain it and turn it into some production in order to supplement their food supplies.
No, I agree 100%. That's why I think Carlos has such a focus on the educational aspect and getting it connected to people that are going to carry it on forward for generations and innovating forward. But I think that's to get adults to change. I think that's why we're focusing on the community aspect so they can learn to help each other and upkeep each other as well.
If any listeners are in the prepper community, that's a community that's very interested in this technology. So get at me, and I'd be glad to help.
And Chris, you had a comment?
I didn't know if you could.
I got one more, and I know you're about ready to get off the air. But, you know, one thing you didn't hit on, we talk about the square footage and acreage, but vertical gardens is a great possibility too. Just think, a vertical garden is just like a pine tree growing straight up, and off of it, from the bottom to the top, is producing plants that's edible. So don't leave out the vertical garden. Look, LA, I'm gonna get off from here. Nice discussion. Good to change up from your normal routine with the Chinese factory and Steve Harvey. I like this. Talk to you later.
Okay. All right, Chris, what do you got for us? Chris, you there, Chris Collins? Well,
can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Brother. I want to say thank you for having this platform, this show, for, having discussions about what it is that this is all about. And
Chris, this is whether you guys know it or not. Okay. This is just part one. you guys got to come back when you can for part two. Because you really brought up some ideas and stimulation. So, what's today, Tuesday? We got it open for you for the rest of the week. Just show up. I'll push the buttons and have you on.
All right.
I would be honored if you would.
Go ahead, brother.
Yeah, man. Now you say you worked at not Chris, but the attorney. You worked at Hughes Aircraft. I have a friend of mine who graduated from George Washington University. He was an EE major himself. And Hughes Aircraft hired him like his junior year out of GW. And he moved out to L.A. and he worked at Hughes Aircraft for a number of years. His name was John Wilson. I don't think he's in
time
engineering
frame?
Anymore, but, you know.
Do you know the rough time frame? I was at Hughes from 87 to 94.
Okay. So he graduated 1980, so that's when he was there. I don't know how many.
Okay.
He was there for several years. I don't know how many years, but he's solely out of the engineering now. He's helping kids get into college now.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, no, I was an engineer for 10 years, and then in 94, Hughes laid off half the company. They laid off. They went from 80,000 to 40,000, and I'm sitting in a room with three empty desks next to me. And I'm like, hey, I think I need a plan B. So I was taking a scuba course, and I met a patent attorney from Hughes Aircraft, you know, the same company.
Right, right. Chris, thank you for setting up a beautiful, great podcast today. Chris, I'm going to let you have the last word, and then we'll log off for the day.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming in today and putting all these topics to discussion. You know, it was such an open discussion. It was a beautiful discussion. And I look forward to the rest of the week and see how these discussions start to unfold and people across the nation, you know, sharing this and letting people know that this is going to be a discussion. But we also are talking about housing. And the housing are coming along with the greenhouse. So the greenhouse that's being built that you're going to live in, there's going to be a greenhouse onto it that you can start supplying even your neighbors with food. This is how community comes together, breaks bread, and understands that it's not just about you and your house. It's about everyone's house. And I want to thank you for this show. It was wonderful. Everybody have a blessed day. And I look forward to speaking to you tomorrow.